is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
When I got the job, to be honest with you, I had this high school coaching mentality of, hey, let's keep our numbers real low. Let's don't bring a bunch of guys in so we don't have to deal with a lot of, you know, in high school, you got to deal with parents and playing time issues and all that. And I literally didn't deal with one issue the entire season. The group of guys that I inherited were a dream come true to coach. And so I kind of changed my recruiting philosophy of, hey, here's a guy that's a good player. And if he has the ability to go through the admissions process and get admitted into Berea College, and I can give him an opportunity to be part of our basketball family, he can go to school here for free, we're going to take a chance on him.
Austin Newton is the men's basketball head coach at Berea College in Kentucky. In his first season at the helm, Newton was named the Collegiate Conference of the South Coach of the Year in the inaugural season of the league. The Mountaineers won the most games since 2016-17, tied for second in the league, and hosted their first ever postseason since joining Division III. Prior to Berea College, Austin served as the head coach at Madison Southern High School in Berea. Before taking the reins at Madison Southern, Newton spent many years at Eastern Kentucky University as a coach and administrator. From 2015 to 2018, he was the Assistant Athletic Director of Development and oversaw the fundraising efforts of the Colonel Club and EKU Athletics. Newton served as the Basketball Director of Operations at EKU from 2008 to 2010, before being promoted to a full-time assistant coach for the Colonels from 2010 to 2015. Before his coaching stint at his alma mater, he spent 2 years at the University of Massachusetts under the tutelage of his college coach, Travis Ford, in the role of video coordinator. Newton played collegiate basketball for 4 years at Eastern Kentucky from 2001 to 2005. He was a senior captain on the 2004-2005 squad that earned a spot in the 2005 NCAA tournament to play the Kentucky Wildcats in the first round. Grab your notebook before you listen to this episode with Austin Newton, men's basketball head coach at Berea College in the state of Kentucky. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is JP Clark, former NBA assistant coach with the Celtics and Clippers, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Grab your notebook before you listen to this episode with Austin Newton, men's basketball head coach at Berea College in the state of Kentucky. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, and we are pleased to be joined by the head men's basketball coach at Berea College in the state of Kentucky, Austin Newton. Austin, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Appreciate you guys having me on. Been a longtime listener of your show and just honored to spend some time with you guys here.
Well, appreciate those kind words. Always means a lot to us to know that there are people out there listening, and we appreciate you being one of those listeners. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball when you were younger.
So grew up in central Kentucky, and of course, like any kid that grows up in the state of Kentucky, loved basketball at a young age. Grew up a diehard Kentucky Wildcat fan. Really started liking it when Rick Pitino became the coach there at UK. I was probably 6 or 7 years old. If you guys remember, Eddie Sutton was on his way out. They were on probation. Season tickets were pretty cheap. So my dad had season tickets, would take me to all the games, and just fell in love with those teams that Patino coached there in the early 90s, and became ate up with basketball. It was my dream to play at UK. Ended up playing for a guy named Travis Ford, who was on those teams at EKU. Favorite player was Jamal Mashburn, and literally would do anything to play for UK. And I was actually Rex Chapman one year for Halloween, would write letters to the guys at UK in the lodge, hoping they'd come see me at my house. But just really fell in love with basketball by watching them, and just developed a love. Just still 5'8", not a very tall guy, so knew I had some challenges in that area. But my love and passion for the game kept me driven to compete at a high level.
What did the Rex Chapman costume look like?
Yeah, so he got cut under his chin one game. I think it was against Louisville. He got cut under his chin, had to get stitches, and he wore this Band-Aid for a while. So had the UK uniform with the Band-Aid and tried to do a Rex Chapman cut.
Nice.
I think he had hair back then.
Yeah, there you go. He definitely had hair back in the day. Rex Chapman, I always say that I would have given my left arm to play one game with Rex Chapman's athleticism just to see what that would have felt like.
He was so good. So athletic, really good player.
Absolutely. There was no question. He was fun. He was a fun guy to watch without a doubt. He was a good guy to try to be a fan of. There's no question about that. When you think about trying to get better as a player, and you obviously are infatuated with the game, you love the Wildcats, you're trying to be the best player that you can become. What do you remember about just how you went about trying to become the best player you could be, let's say back when you were a high school player?
Dad was a huge influence on me as a basketball player. So when I was young, we had a small court down in our basement that had two regulation size goals on it, but the ceiling was really low. But it gave me a chance to go down there and work on my ball handling, and was just spent a lot of time in that basement. And then when I got to high school, he actually he got me a full court in my backyard to play. So just spent a lot of time out there. Had an older brother that was 4 years older than I, and had a lot of kids around the neighborhood that we would just get out and play. And like I said, I was undersized, and I knew that I had to fight and compete to play with the older guys. And it's probably the best way that I learned was just playing against older competition, and just didn't have AAU back then. Not until my junior or senior year of high school did AAU really come on the scene. But just loved it so much, was always shooting. Watched Hoosiers movie, just infatuated with the game of basketball, and just couldn't go a day without it.
What's your favorite memory of being a high school player?
Favorite memory as a high school player? It's probably not the best memory, but it taught me the most about myself as a player, and as a life lesson was my freshman year in high school. We made it to the regional championship against the biggest school in the state of Kentucky, against North Hardin. And of course, I played at a very small school, graduated with 80 kids. But long story short, regional championship game, my high school hadn't been to the state tournament. Of course, you guys know in Kentucky, we don't have a class system. It's basically little guys play the big guys. But anyway, we're playing in the regional championship, and North Hardin's holding for the last shot. I got thrown in there as a freshman, a senior heavy team, 10 or 11 guys, holding for the last shot, and they miss it, and the ball comes back to me about the free throw line, and I wrap my arms around the ball and hey, we're going to overtime. And one of their guys comes up from behind me and tries to smack it away, and he fouls me with no time left on the clock. So here I go to the free throw line with 0 seconds on the clock to send my team to the state tournament, and felt great about the first one. That sucker rimmed in and out, and then I got a little nervous on the second one and short-armed it. And then we ended up losing the game in triple overtime. While you asked me about what my best memory was, it wasn't my best, but it was probably the most meaningful memory. It was because when I missed those free throws, I knew that I let a lot of people down. Didn't go to school for a few days, embarrassed, but somehow picked myself up and became a top 5 free throw shooter in the state the next season. And it just really created this inner drive within me to prove people wrong and really, set me on fire to be the best player that I could be.
It's funny how I think when I think about memories, that a lot of times it's a loss or it's something that didn't go well that you remember. In fact, it's funny. So I'll just share this story. This is one, Jason, I'll keep him awake over there. I've never shared this story on the podcast. So I was sitting yesterday, coming home. I was driving actually with my daughter and my wife. We were coming back from one of my daughter's soccer games and we were picking up pizza and we stopped in at like this strip mall where there was a pizza place and that didn't exist. And I live in the town where I grew up and this particular pizza place didn't exist, but it was on this road where, again, it's like the main road through town. And I remember I was sitting there and my wife went in to pick up the pizza and I was sitting there like, man, I remember what used to be here when I was in high school. And I remember one time that I had this game against Berea, but not Berea College, Berea High School here in the state of Ohio. And it was when I was a sophomore and I had 2 points. I think it was my worst game of the season. And I remember it was snowing and I was so mad that I walked home from the high school and it wasn't super far, but it's probably a good mile and a half from the high school to my house. And I remember walking home after the game and I walked like where this pizza place used to be or where this pizza place is now. I walked like basically through that area, like behind, because there was a lot less development at the time. And just that's a memory that sticks with me. Like I probably don't remember much of anything about that season in terms of like wins or big games I had, but it's like those things that where you fell short of what your expectations were that drive you. And that's something that, again, I was just thinking about it yesterday. It was kind of interesting. So yeah, I think those memories that where we don't maybe live up to our own expectations, where those are things that we remember most vividly and then they drive us moving forward.
Exactly. As bad as it was at the time, like if I make one of those free throws and we go to the state tournament and I'm the hero, like my life could have turned out a lot differently. So thankful looking back, you know, 25 years ago now, but at the time it was really, really bad.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's a tough one to – it was certainly a tough one to show up for school next day. Let's put it that way.
We had 10 or 11 seniors that were just really great leaders and just great guys and just really disappointed that I let them down was the biggest part of it. But hopefully we've all moved on.
Hopefully. All right. Talk a little bit about your college decision and where you were in terms of why you decided to attend Eastern Kentucky and just what were some of the opportunities that you had or didn't have as a player coming out of high school.
I was an undersized guard, very good ball handler, could shoot it, good high school player, not the greatest high school player, probably wasn't a Division I player. Getting a lot of interest, Division III, Division II. Was also a really good golfer in high school and baseball player. So basketball, looking back, was probably my third best sport, but just really loved it more than the other sports. So decided that I wanted to play college. And Travis Ford, who I spoke about earlier, played at University of Kentucky. He's now at St. Louis. He was coaching there at a local college, Campbellsville University, there in my hometown. And so him being about 5'8", me being about 5'8", I think he had a special place in his heart for small guards. And he was recruiting me to come to Campbellsville, which is an NAIA school there. And so my senior year of high school is when he got the job at Eastern Kentucky University. And when he got the job, just stayed in contact with him and gave me the opportunity to walk on there at EKU, which I couldn't pass up. It was a dream of mine to play at the highest level. And again, probably wasn't a Division I player, but couldn't pass that opportunity up to go to EKU.
What was your experience like in that first year, that first month as a walk-on player? Because I know that, again, from talking to guys that have played Division I basketball at different schools and in different places, that depending upon the program, an experience for a walk-on can be completely different. I'm guessing that yours was a pretty positive one considering the way that your career kind of moved along. But just talk a little bit about how that experience went for you as a walk-on in that first year, that the first semester.
So got to EKU in 2001, and EKU at that time was literally, I don't know how many Division I schools there are now in the country, but literally last RPI-wise, like worst team in the country. So not coming into a great situation. And Travis Ford, that was his second year there trying to rebuild the program, and actually came in my freshman year and started about 11 games as a walk-on. And so it's funny. I tell my team this at Bree all the time. We were so bad that on the day of games, like at shoot around, we would play 5-on-5 at shoot around to see who got the start that night. And so, I mean, I prided myself on playing really hard, and I was like, hey, you're going to give me a chance to start tonight. I'm going to go out there and try to win this game. So, got to play a lot my freshman year. Got to start against Louisville and Rick Pitino at Freedom Hall and played like 36 minutes. So really was living a dream, even though we just weren't winning. I think we won 7 games that year. Then my sophomore year, we got a really good point guard in from Tip City, Ohio, named Matt Witt. Was all-time leading scorer there at EKU for a while. So when he showed up, it was great for our team, not great for my playing time. So that year really was tough on me, not playing for the first time in my life, and had some doubts about, do I want to keep doing this and what's my plan? And then I think it was that year I really felt like that I wanted to become a coach. And so I just took every opportunity at practice and in games to just soak up as much as I could to learn about coaching. And then my junior season, we turned the corner as a team, and I think we had a 500 record, which was like winning the NBA finals for us at EKU during that time. Then my senior year, had a special season. They picked me as one of the captains of the team, even though I didn't play at all. I guess they thought enough of my leadership to make me a captain. And we won 23 games that year, went to the NCAA tournament, and got to play Kentucky, of all teams, in the NCAA tournament, and played them really tough. It was a tie game with about 5 minutes left, and met my wife there at EKU. We got 2 kids now. So looking back, it was a pretty good decision to walk on there and go to the NCAA tournament and meet my wife.
All right. So how did you shift your mentality? You go from a guy who plays a lot as a freshman. Obviously, your team isn't having a tremendous amount of success, but you're still out on the floor, you're playing. And clearly, as a player, you were in a state tournament game as a freshman in high school. So clearly, you playing a lot as a high school player. So to go from a guy who's playing a lot and being out on the floor and being an important member of the team as a point guard to suddenly to go from that to, all right, now I'm not playing. How did you shift your mentality, and how did you remain a positive force, which obviously you did since you were named a captain, as you mentioned, as a senior? How did you do that? How did you change your mentality to accept sort of what your role was and continue to move forward in a positive way? Because it would be really easy for somebody to be like, oh man, I'd be a little bit bitter or think about, hey, maybe I should go somewhere else so I can play more. Just how'd you handle that?
It's really tough, and something that I use when I talk with my players here at Berea and every coaching stop that I've been. And basically, you know, I tell them the same thing, like went from playing a lot to not playing. It was probably the hardest year of sports in my life. And it wasn't like an overnight change my mindset, like I'm okay with not playing. It was like, hey, I'm still competing to play, but I also know that I have value as a leader. I have value on the scout team. So we'll talk about that a little bit later on. When I was an assistant at EKU, I was on the scout team basically from my sophomore year of college up to, I'm still playing on the scout team. Actually, my son's middle name's Scout because I've been on the scout team for so long.
Nice.
Kind of took on that scout team role of just giving those guys great looks. Really enjoyed my teammates. Still best friends with a lot of them. We still talk a lot. So I think after I finally realized, like, hey, I still want to compete and I still want to try to play, but I know I'm not better than these other guys. So I'm just going to try to, again, I want to be a coach. I'm going to soak up as much as I can, but I'm also going to try to help our team at EKU turn the corner and, you know, be relevant again and get to that NCAA tournament. So took a while, but finally made that shift happen.
What are some things that you did as a teammate that when you talk to your players today and you're having conversations with guys who maybe aren't playing as much as they want to, and not that you necessarily say, hey, well, back in my day, this is what I did, but just lessons that you learned that you can pass on to guys who maybe aren't getting the kind of minutes they would like, to show them how they can impact their team, even though they're maybe not playing the minutes that they want to?
I think, you know, everything matters as far as, you know, maybe going a rebound for the best player when he's shooting at warmups. Like, it's sometimes you'll see a walk-on like myself out there trying to get threes up before the game. Like, hey, if you know that you're not going to play, like, won't you be a great teammate and go down there and rebound for this guy that's really going to help us win this game? It's a very hard shift to make mentality-wise, but just being positive, talking to them when they come to the bench, talking to them before the game, making sure they're focused. Like, I know that all sounds cliche and like something simple that should be done, but it's really hard for a college kid that wants to play to make that adjustment to be that teammate and to be that leader when you're not on the court. So,
yeah, I give you a lot of credit for doing that because I know it's not easy. And I had 1 year in my career as a player when I was a freshman in college where I didn't play. And it was a tough year. I mean, it was a tough, tough year to go and compete at my hardest every day in practice and know that even if I played really, really well in a given week or a given practice or a given game, that I was probably going to get, you know, maybe maximum 6 or 8 minutes at the most, and more likely I was going to get nothing. And that's tough. I mean, that was tough for me to sort of make that adjustment. And I can't imagine trying to make it where it was more of a, hey, this looks like the writing on the wall, that this is kind of a permanent thing. And it's good, I'm sure, for you that you started to shift your focus, as you said, to thinking about coaching and starting to look at things more from a coaching perspective as opposed to a playing perspective. When you finally graduated, what was the idea? Were you immediately thinking, hey, I got to go out and start looking for coaching jobs? Were you in any way, shape, or form thinking about getting a quote unquote real job, or were you completely sold on coaching? And then what did that coaching search look like?
I was not completely sold on coaching. Again, I had a pretty serious girlfriend who's now my wife, and was just going to graduate and start looking for jobs, and knew that coaching, you know, was kind of on the back burner. If something popped up that made sense, like I would definitely do it. So actually needed a summer class to graduate. And during the summer while I was in classes, my coach, Travis Ford, he had just got the job at UMass because we had such a good year there at EKU, went to the NCAA tournament, got the job at UMass and called me during that summer and said, hey, we got a video coordinator job open for you. Would love to have you. Obviously take some time to think about it. And I did have to take a lot of time because I didn't want to leave my wife. And of course, moving from Kentucky to Massachusetts was something that was a little scary for this Southern boy. but finally just did enough research on it and just thought it was a great opportunity for a first job right out of college that not a lot of other guys would get a chance at.
Did your wife come with you?
She did not. So she was a teacher for a while and she had some student teaching to do. So spent 2 years there and she told me it was time to move back, which I did. And so moved back, got married and got back down south.
What was the learning curve like in the video room?
Yeah, it was a lot. So this was back when VHS tapes were still going on. So, I mean, just me, like, and I was just clueless on how much time coaches spent breaking down film, doing scout reports, up all night. And then, of course, it's my job to splice all that together. So I'm up all night just working a lot of hours, exhausted. So it was a tough job. I wish we had synergy and all the technology that we had now, but we just didn't. But learned a lot, not only about, you know, scouting reports and video, but just getting to watch so many good teams, like in the Atlantic 10 Conference, like offense, defense, just learned so much about basketball during those 2 years, just watching it over and over and over, preparing for our opponents. So definitely a great first job in a big time basketball conference to kind of get my feet wet.
Did you start putting together things that you liked? Were you starting to anticipate, hey, these are things that I need to kind of commit to memory? Or just what was your process for growing while you're doing that? Or were you just so enmeshed in the job that it was like, hey, I just got to get this together for the coaching staff?
So to be honest, Coach Ford was all I knew because I played for him and then worked for him. So I really hadn't been under any other coaches to learn any other system. So, I mean, I knew all his stuff, his philosophy, offense, defense. So it was good for me to see other teams, but it wasn't really until I got to EKU with Jeff Neubauer where I learned basically a totally different philosophy, different culture, which really helped me as a coach. But definitely taking notes on actions that I like from other teams, but was really set in the thinking that, hey, if I were to get a head coaching job here soon, like I would basically take, you know, the Travis Ford philosophy, plays, offense, defense, all that with me.
So after you have that experience at UMass with Coach Ford, and then you get the opportunity to go back home, you reunite with your future wife, and you're back at your alma mater. What do you remember about that interview process? Because clearly, I'm assuming that you didn't have a relationship with Coach Neubauer prior to that. So just what was that interview process like?
I did actually meet Coach Neubauer there before I took off to UMass, and spent some time with him talking about the guys that were returning on the team there for his first year. And it's a funny story. I didn't start working there until about a year and a half after I got back from UMass. My dad owns it's called Lee's Famous Recipe. It's a fried chicken place.
Yeah, I know that.
He's owned for 40 years, and it's down in Danville, Kentucky. And so when I moved back, I didn't have a job. Like, I came back, I just quit my job at UMass to come home and get married and try to find something else. Worked for Edward Jones for like 6 months, then started frying chicken. Never worked for my dad before in my life. And a guy named Josh Merkel, who I'm sure
yep, everybody's got Josh on. Yep.
Yeah, Randolph-Macon. He was actually an assistant there at EKU, and I had a pretty good relationship with Mert throughout the years. And so I'm frying chicken down at Lee's Famous Recipe. I've got my hand down in flour, like getting ready to put the next batch of chicken in, and Merkel's calling me. And he's basically saying that they had an operations position open there at EKU. And so I couldn't get my apron off fast enough to tell him, hey, I'd love a chance at that job. So Mert called and went and met with him, and started there the next couple weeks. And my first 3 years there, I spent in operations. So basically doing all the things that Adobo does, from meals to travel, to the laundry, all that good stuff. And then spent 5 years there as a full-time recruiting assistant.
What was it like going from, because obviously as the video coordinator, you're not on the floor. And then as the ops guy, you're not on the floor. When you finally got an opportunity to get out on the floor and actually coach, what did that feel like? And just, I'm sure that that's obviously something that you had wanted to do, but clearly it's a different animal altogether in terms of sort of the things that, as you described, what you were doing before. So what was it like for you just going from, again, being sort of, in the back room to being out on the floor with the guys?
A tough transition, to be honest. I'm a quiet guy by nature. And so to jump on that court and Coach Neubauer, he would actually send me an email every morning saying, hey, Newt, you're going to have the best practice you've ever had vocally at EKU today. And he would pump me up every morning because he knew I was quiet. He knew I struggled, speaking up. And, of course, didn't want to say anything out of line, but like finally learned over time how to project my voice and how to throw myself in the mix and get in there. And, of course, being on scout team there helped me with that. But it was for a quiet guy, really had a lot of help and guidance from Coach Neubauer to say, hey, you really know what you're talking about. Jump in there and coach these guys up.
How long was it before you felt the confidence to really do that? Was it sometime during that first season? What did it take? Less than that, longer than that, where you really felt like you found your voice?
After you break the ice and you throw yourself in the mix, I would say toward the end of that first season, I finally felt confident. Of course, presenting scouting reports and watching film with the guys, and it's your show, and you got the laptop in your hand, you got the laser pointer, and you're showing actions. Like, it's nervous, especially at that level. Like, it's a serious business. So as scary as it was, like, it helped me to learn to, again, just – I know what I'm talking about, to be confident in my approach, and just really learned a lot about myself in that year.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing when you start talking about the higher levels you go up. It's really about, can you help the players get better, right? Guys start to trust you and believe in you when they know that you know your stuff. And I've talked to so many coaches that have talked about that, hey, if you have not the confidence, but the competence to know what you're doing, to be able to help players get better, that guys are going to buy into who you are as a coach, that they know you care about them and they know you want to get them better and you have the tools to be able to do that. I think that's a big piece of being able to have success. When you think about your time as an assistant there at Eastern Kentucky, what are some things, one or two lessons that you took away from that experience that have helped you as you moved on in your career and that you kind of have applied to what you're doing now at Berea?
Coach Neubauer, like, everything mattered as far as the detail of how meals on the road were going to happen. To I remember he called me in early in my tenure there, and he's like, "New, we want to make the big time where we're at. We want Eastern Kentucky to seem like it's Duke to our players." And so whether that was as small as putting a logo on an itinerary to give the guys when we travel on the road, to having Gatorade in the locker, like just little things to make it feel like a big time program. The way we promoted ourselves, social media wasn't huge back then, but he really was big on, you know, promoting our brand and our culture, which is something that's really helping us at Berea right now. And then I would say just this, the guys that I got to work with there at EKU during my time, talk about Josh Merkel, who's at Randolph-Macon, won a D3 national championship, Dale Wellman, Nebraska Wesleyan, won a D3 national championship. Ted Hotelling, who's now at New Haven, a guy named Everett Sullivan, who's at Lenoir Ryan, Richie Riley, one of my best friends in the world, is at South Alabama. He's got an assistant named Rodney Crawford, who spent some time there with me. A guy named Luke Strege, he's at a JUCO Mineral Area Junior College. So just you think about all the guys that were there at the same time, just to be able to learn from all those guys about how coaching works, recruiting. The experiences and the lessons that I learned from all those guys are just invaluable.
At one point there, you transitioned from coaching to the administrative side. Talk about that change and why it came to be.
Yeah, so toward the end of my time there as an assistant, we had three of the best seasons in EKU history, won a lot of games, made another NCAA tournament in 2014 and played Kansas and played them really tough. I actually had the scouting report, which is probably my coolest memory from being on staff. So getting to set in that first seed against Wiggins and Embiid and those guys in that first round game was pretty surreal. But Coach Neubauer got the opportunity to go to Fordham University up in the Bronx, New York. And so when I moved home from UMass and got married, I made a promise to my wife and to my family that I don't want to be one of those coaches that moves my family across the country chasing jobs. And it's just a commitment that I'd made to them, and I wanted to stand by it. So Coach Neubauer did give me the opportunity to go up there and to be an assistant, top assistant with him at Fordham. And it's something that I thought about, but just couldn't get the wifey to go from Berea to the Bronx. And so EKU ended up getting a new coach in. And so I was trying to, you know, I was trying to stick around and stay on staff, and just wasn't able to. And it's, you know, college basketball is a business, and new coach wanted to bring his own assistants, which I totally understand. And went and actually talked with the president of EKU at that time and just told him, you know, love this university and really want to continue to help in any way that I can. And got a position as a fundraiser for athletics. And so did that for about 2.5 years, and it was a great job. Like, really liked what I did. Got to meet a lot of EKU alums, did a lot of great things raising money for EKU athletics. But after that 2.5 years, just really missed coaching, missed being a part of a team more than anything. And so I had to find my way back in.
All right. So you then at that point leave the college ranks and go back to high school. So what was that decision-making process like? And then what was the adjustment in terms of just your approach and how you felt about coaching high school players versus coaching at the college level?
Yeah, so went and coached at Madison Southern High School, which is actually here in Berea, Kentucky, literally right across the street from where I'm coaching at now, Berea College. My wife actually went to school at Madison Southern. She's an alum. And so had followed the program for many years, knew a lot about it, knew the old coach really well. And so when he left, just thought it was a good opportunity for me to get back into coaching and to be a head coach for the first time in my life. And when I got down there, it was kind of eye-opening because, of course, coming from Division I, I'm going in early trying to do all these workouts and individual instruction. Like, these guys can't even put weights on a barbell. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, hold on now. Like, we just had to start from zero and really take our time in the process of trying to develop some sort of program.
What was the key to the success when you eventually sort of unlocked it? What did you have to do in order to kind of connect with high school players and to build a good high school program that, I don't know if it was different necessarily from college, but just what unlocked being a good high school coach for you?
Yeah, so the high school that I was at is in a very good basketball region in Kentucky, the 11th region, really athletic, tough region. And so Madison Southern had never won a game in the regional tournament, which is school had been there for 33 years. So that was our goal. And so Southern had a lot of good teams over the year, but the whole culture was kind of this culture of mediocrity, of just not believing that we could compete with these other schools. So the biggest thing we had to do was like create this belief that we can compete with these guys and we can beat them. And, you know, with that belief, you got to put the work in the weight room. You got to put the work in on the court, and you got to have a system and a culture that allows you to do that. But I think the biggest thing is that we just made guys believe that they were really good. And so we did that a few ways by pumping them up, talking to them, but also by trying to help them, you know, individually, and just creating this sense of belief that we can compete and we can beat these teams.
Talk about the amount of time that you had to put in as a high school coach in order to get the program where you wanted to go. Because I think it's one of the things that has really changed in the last 25 or 30 years in terms of the amount of time that a high school coach has to put in just to forget about being at the highest level, but just the baseline, the bar has been set now in terms of the amount of time that coaches have to put in, much, much higher than it used to be. So talk about just the time that you put in year round in order to get that program where you wanted it to be.
Freshman, a JV program, a varsity program. You got a youth league. We had a youth league with over 400 kids in it, which I think is very important in building a good high school team, is having good young players coming up. I don't have a teaching degree. I was a public relations major, so didn't have a teaching degree, but knew that I needed to be in the school in order to see my guys to try to create that culture that we wanted. I couldn't just, you know, work a job during the day and just show up at practice and really build those relationships that I knew that I needed to in order for us to be successful. So I actually was a credit recovery teacher for a couple years.
Yep.
And then became the testing coordinator there for a year. But just I thought that it was that important for me to see my guys in the hallway every day and just, you know, check on their academics and, hey, this is the way that we do things and I'm here for you if you need me. And so I think me being around that much really helped our culture. But like you said, even during the summertime, like we were playing 25, 30 games in June, and it's a nonstop year round deal now in high school. And it's a lot.
Well, and people, I think there's so many different rules across states that Kentucky is one of those states where you guys still have unlimited access, correct, to your players in the offseason?
Unlimited or limited?
Unlimited, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, to be able to look, there's a lot of states of coaches that would love to have more access or have unlimited access. But the reality is, when you have unlimited access, that means that you better be doing a lot of things, because there are guys that are taking advantage of that unlimited access to do a whole lot with their guys. There's no question about that, I'm sure.
We had work to do. And so while you can't make everything mandatory, when you say unlimited access, you can't make everything mandatory.
Right.
for those guys that want to show up and get better, we wanted to be there for them. We wanted to give them that opportunity to get better, because the fact of the matter, we did have to improve and get much better in the weight room and on the court to compete with the teams that were in our region.
What was your favorite part about coaching in the high school level?
Our last year there at Southern, we beat our rival, Madison Central, who's got a great Hall of Fame coach, Alan Feldhaus. We beat them in the district championship, which has only been done 3 times now. And then we were able to win that game in the region tournament that had never been done. So that was a very special moment, just to see over the 4 years the work that we had put in and the culture that we had built for that to pay off, and just to see the happiness on the kids' faces and in the school and the community. They just really rallied behind our team. I think, you know, that sense of pride and community support that you get at the high school level is unmatched at any level. It's a feeling that you can't get at the college level.
How hard was it then to walk away when the Berea College job becomes open or becomes available to you?
It was really tough. Mainly we had everybody coming back off that team that we had some success with. So that was in the play. Knew I'd put a lot of time and investment in trying to make that team really good, that program good. And then I even told the administration at Berea College when I interviewed, I said, hey, listen, I've lived here for 15 years. And I just, to be honest, I don't know a lot about the job. I don't know a lot about the team. I don't know when they play. I haven't been to a game in probably 15 years, and I literally live 5 minutes down the road. And so it was scary, but the more research that I did about the institution, it just made sense for me to give it a shot.
All right, let's start here for people like myself who aren't familiar with the uniqueness of the institution there of Berea College. Talk to me a little bit about just what makes Berea so unique, and then we can dive into more of the basketball side of it.
Berea College is one of a handful of schools. It's a no tuition work study college. So basically every student that attends Berea College does not pay any tuition. And so with that comes some prerequisites in order to be admitted into the school. So you got to have really good grades. And you got to come from a low-income family in order to be admitted at Berea College. I think it's a land of opportunity. Again, like I said before, I lived here 15 years. I drove past the college every single day for the last 15 years. I really had no clue, like, the mission of the school. I mean, I always knew kind of like – I just thought of it a place where, oh, people go to school for free there, but had no idea, like, the mission of the college. And the longer I'm here, the more I'm in love with what this college does for students that wouldn't have opportunity to go to college because of their financial situation. So a really unique deal, especially now that we're Division III. So Berea College has had a basketball team since 1895. I learned that a few weeks ago. So 128 years of basketball, was NAIA for a long time, and then made the switch to Division III back in 2017. And remember when they went Division III, like thinking, man, you're talking about a school where you can get in and not pay any tuition, but it's Division III. I was like, wow, that may be like the only D3 job in the country that's like that. And so always been intrigued by that Division III Berea College deal. So that was another factor in play when I took the job.
In the interview process, what question or questions did you have for the administration there that were important to you before you took the job?
We have a beautiful facility. We've got 2 gyms. We've got 2,000-seat chairback arena, like just a top-notch facility. And I was thinking the whole time, like, this is just too – I felt like it was a gold mine type of job, in my opinion. And just wanted to really see how much they valued athletics around campus. It is a very high academic, great school. You get a Berea College degree, you can get about any job you want. So it's very high academic. So just wanted to make sure that administration athletically was on board and trying to make our basketball team really good and relevant again. And Everything that I heard from them is that they wanted to do that, and we all got on the same page, and they've stood by that, and I think we're well on our way to really getting this thing going again.
What was the biggest challenge in your first year?
I would say how busy our student athletes are. So I think I mentioned part of being a Berea College student and going to school for free is you got to work a job on campus 10 hours a week, 2 hours per day. And so just trying to find that time to practice, and it's either go 6 a.m. or last year we went about 7 p.m. every night just to try to get everybody there, because the jobs are different times throughout the day. So I think the biggest challenge was just how busy these guys are with school and studying and working the job, and got to attend a convocation every Thursday where they have different speakers. So just navigating the schedules of the guys was the toughest part.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. So you obviously inherit a roster of guys, and you got the job late last fall. And so I'm sure that trying to be able to recruit when you get the job in September, not very easy to bring in a new set of guys to help contribute to this season. So this is kind of your first off season of recruiting. And I'd have to imagine that as you're recruiting guys, there's an educational component in terms of you being able to and having to explain to players and families what Berea College is all about. And I'm sure there's some local guys that are maybe familiar with it, but generally speaking, when you start going out on the recruiting trail, what's that been like? What's the pitch? And then what kind of players are you targeting?
We only lost two guys off last year's team, so I wasn't really thinking that we needed a lot. And somehow we've ended up with 12 guys coming to us next year. So
okay,
we are going to start us a JV program. And so I'd heard a lot of bad stories about how hard it is to recruit here. And I do think a lot of those are true, but I also think the opposite of we've got something that no other Division III school can really offer, which is a full ride. That's a good selling point. I've just got to be very proactive in the guys that we're recruiting as far as doing some research on them before I go watch them play. So it does me no good to go to an AAU event and just pull up, set up shop and be like, hey, I like that guy and I like this guy because, you know, his parents may be lawyers and no way he can get into school here. So I got to do a lot of work on the front end, just making sure it's the right fit academically and financially. So that's just been the biggest part for me, is trying to find those guys. And, you know, being from this area and knowing a lot of the high school coaches really helps, because I can reach out and email, call those guys and say, hey, you know what we're looking for at Berea College. Do you have any guys that would fit what we're looking for?
So off that initial list, then, once you have guys that you've identified or people have helped you to identify that would be a good fit, both in terms of their family situation, their academics, talk about the evaluation process. How much do you value what you see in AAU versus high school? Are there certain things that you're looking for in each environment? How do you identify which of the guys that are on that initial list that you really want to target and bring onto your campus?
Yeah, we really value skill. We only had one guy over 6'4 last year, so extremely small. So we do need some size, and we got us some size coming in for next season. So was really looking for some guys that can rebound and defend and score in the paint. But when I got the job, to be honest with you, I had like this high school coaching mentality of, hey, let's keep our numbers real low. Let's don't bring a bunch of guys in so we don't have to deal with a lot of, you know, in high school, you got to deal with parents and playing time issues and all that. And like, I literally didn't deal with one issue the entire season. Like, the group of guys that I inherited were a dream come true to coach. And so I kind of changed my recruiting philosophy of, hey, here's a guy that's a good player. And if he has the ability to go through the admissions process and get admitted into Berea College, and I can give him an opportunity to be part of our basketball family, he can go to school here for free, like, we're going to take a chance on him. And so we're not real picky about, like, you know, we're not taking him and we're taking this guy. It's, hey, if you apply to Berea and you get accepted, then you're a really good student. You come from a special situation. And if you want to be a part of our program, then we're going to give you an opportunity, whether that's on the JV team, a manager. Like, I want to help kids, especially if I can help somebody get a free education and be a part of something bigger than themselves. Like, that's what I'm really looking for.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, again, when you start thinking about what you do as a coach, I mean, clearly there's a one loss element and the basketball side of it. But being able to have that kind of huge impact, I think really speaks to what coaching is all about. And you mentioned a couple of times now about getting a JV program started. What's that like? What's the process like for, hey, we're going to start a JV program? What hurdles do you have to go through in order to be able to get that done?
Great question. That's what I'm learning right now. I do have two part-time assistant coaches here. I think most Division III schools, you know, not blessed with a bunch of full-time guys running around. So I got two assistants that are great, but they're both high school teachers during the day. So I think it's just going to have to be a cumulative effort of us taking on a JV program. Going to have to probably have some tough conversations with some guys early in the year of, hey, you're going to be strictly JV. We can't have, you know, 30 guys on the bench for a varsity game, so to speak. So going to have to be some conversations and just making sure everybody's on the same page about how we're going about it. I do think these 8 extra days that have been given to us in Division III will really help, you know, kind of not necessarily use it as a tryout, but for us to be able to evaluate all of our guys together in the gym. I think those 8 days are really going to help us, but going to need to find several JV games. And I know back in the day, there's a legendary coach here at Berea College named Roland Werwilly, all-time winningest coach, and they had a JV program his whole time. And I just think it's a great way for guys that, you know, at transition period when you come in as a freshman to still play college basketball, to learn about our system. I just think it's a great advantage moving forward to find some guys that are playing well and maybe pull them up to the varsity level.
How many guys are you going to have in your gym during those 8 days?
Well, thankfully, we've got two gyms. I hope both gyms are open because both of them might be running. So I'm trying to figure out if we're going to go two gyms or if we're going to split times. But that's something that I need to figure out here.
That's funny. That is good stuff. What about the on-campus jobs? What are some things that some of your guys are doing for the job portion of the experience there at Berea?
Yeah, so they're really all over the place. We got a guy that actually works here in our arena. He comes in from 6 to 8 in the morning, and you'll see him mopping the floors, and he'll be vacuuming my office when I come in the morning. How you doing, coach? And got a guy that works over at the dining facility. We've got guys that are RAs in dorms. We got a guy that works over at the post office on campus. He's always texting me, coach, we got packaging. Think it's new good for him. So just pretty cool to see all the jobs. And again, that's, people always say that scares recruits off when you start talking about the job, but our guys really do enjoy working their jobs. They learn a lot from it, and they actually get paid a little bit to do it. It's
nice.
It's a little less than minimum wage, but you're still getting paid and you're learning life skills.
Yeah, it's really good. I think you can see the value in that. And you can also see where it's attractive. I mean, when I think about, I'm sort of unique in the way that I grew up, and I never really had a job. I don't know about you, but did you have a job when you were a kid?
I did not. Not until I worked at Lee's, like I was telling you.
Yeah, there you go. See, I never had a job. I mean, I had a paper out when I was maybe like 8 or 9, And other than that, like I never worked in a fast food restaurant. I never delivered pizza. I never had a regular job because I was all basketball all the time. But yet I think, you know, like in today's world, there's so many kids, athletes and otherwise, that have jobs that are kind of used to that way of doing things, that I would think that, you know, that ability to have a job, obviously the free tuition that goes along with it clearly helps. But, you know, I think there's a lot of guys that probably appreciate the opportunity to have a job. And like you said, to be able to put some money in their pocket. I'm sure that, again, there's probably guys that maybe that turns off, but I would think that it would be a net positive really when it comes down to it.
Absolutely. They're very grateful for everything that you do for them. My first team meeting as the coach here, I was, you know, talking to them about myself and my philosophy. And then to end the meeting, I was like, guys, what do we need right now to be successful at Berea College? Like, give me something that I can do for us to be successful. And the room got real quiet. Nobody had said anything. Finally, one guy raises his hand. He's like, Coach, can we get ice after open gym? And I was like, yeah, I can get you some ice. I was like, is there anything else that we need? And another guy raises it. He's from London, England. He's like, Coach, can we get some trousers this year? He's like, we've had travel suit jackets, but we haven't had any travel pants for the last 2 or 3 years. And I'm like, yeah, I got you, Prince. Like, I said, is there anything else like other than ice and travel pants? Like, nope, we're good, Coach. So just the mentality of the student that goes here, like just high level thinkers, very smart and appreciative of everything that you do for them, which also translates well to the court. I mean, you think about coaching guys that are very cerebral, that can remember plays and are hungry to prove people wrong. Like, it's a very good combination to coach.
Pants and ice, man. You got to figure out a way to incorporate that. Yeah, you got to get that on the t-shirt, man. Pants and ice. figure out some like hidden meaning for that. That somehow, you know, you tie it into something. I kind of like that. There's some good logos you could go with that, man. There's a lot of things you could play off of that. I kind of like it, man. When you come up with the pants and ice t-shirt, I'm going to expect you to send me one.
Yeah, it's trousers. You got to say trousers.
Trousers. There you go. That makes it even better. From London, ice and trousers. I like it.
I said it two or three times, and I couldn't understand what he was saying. Trousers. Trousers. I was finally like, he's saying pants, Coach.
That's hilarious. That is funny. That's good stuff. All right. Talk to me a little bit about practice planning. What's your process for putting together a good practice?
I take it from Jeff Neubauer, who's a master planner. When I was an assistant for Coach Neubauer, we would literally meet every day before practice for hours upon a time. He had this circle table in his office. It looked like a chess table. It was the logo of our court was on this table, and he had little men that he would move around. And like, Coach Newt, you're going to be under this basket, and he would put five players over there. Like, he was very specific about how practice would go. And so I've taken that concept, and unfortunately don't get my assistants since they're working other jobs, but try to prepare as much as I can, you know, making out team. If we're going to play 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5, making sure I'm not wasting time in practice saying, you go here. Like, I've got my team set. Spend a lot of time at the beginning of practice, getting ourselves loose, working on skill, shooting. We'll work, depending on what time of year we're in, we'll do some defensive stuff, and then, obviously some scouting and some live action stuff toward the end.
How do you balance out how much you stop play versus how much you let things flow and then talk to players as they come off on the side, or maybe review it with them on film, or talk to them again during a break? I know that's one of the things that we talk to coaches, that everybody's trying to figure out that balance, right? Of how much do you interject? What are you focusing on? So just what's your philosophy in terms of coaching during the practice and stopping the flow?
I think it depends on how long you've been the coach somewhere. So this year is my first year, and I literally officially got hired on October 3rd, and our first practice, you know, is October 15th. So didn't have a lot of time to really, you know, talk about because at the Division III level, you can't even talk hoops with them until October 15th. So it's like October 15th, we're thrown into the fire. So this past season, I probably spent too much time talking. We spent a lot of time watching film. I am a big believer in film. We probably watched too much. Had a guy on our team who's probably my favorite player I've ever coached named Isaac Cottle. And after our first film session, he came up to me. He's from Eastern Kentucky. And he's like, "Coach, we going to watch that much film every day?" And so I was just – to me, it was just natural because that's what I've always done. Even at the high school level, we watch a ton of film. I think it's the best way to learn. But, you know, as I'm here longer and as the guys get used to who I am as a coach and our system, we won't have to watch as much. But did spend more time than I wanted this past season teaching and watching film.
How do you balance out when you're watching film between showing the players what they need to do? In other words, looking at things they did wrong versus picking out things that they did well. Are you conscious of trying to have a good balance between those two, or are you just really trying to figure out what's the best way for us to teach it?
Yeah, I'm huge on positivity, not only with film, but just my coaching style, and just always try to find the good, the positive. So won't watch a lot of negative clips. If we had 30 clips we were going to watch, I would say 27 or 28 of those are going to be really positive, and the two negative are going to have to be really, really bad or just a teaching point of some sort. But just really big on showing guys things that they're doing well. I can also take positive clips and kind of focus on somebody else during the play of, hey, you know, Trey Minter's getting ready to make a great move right here, but look at what he's doing in the corner as far as spotting up, just, you know, making several points on one clip that are positive and maybe throw in a couple negatives like, hey, you should be here instead of here. So definitely more positive than negative when it comes to film.
When are you watching it with the guys? Are you watching before practice, after practice, separate from practice? What's the process?
We always watch it before practice. I just think it gives good guys time to, you know, come in, get dressed, and then focus in on what we did the day before, and gives them an opportunity to kind of think about it as we go out there and stretch and get ready for practice. Do like to call guys in individually to my office to watch clips, maybe see something individually. Don't want to show them from the team, but can present it to them in a way, you know, individually in my office that'll resonate better with them instead of in front of the team.
Yeah, I think that sometimes that's a balance, right? To be able to have things that you feel like everybody can benefit, and then maybe there's some things that you need to dial in on with the individual player to be able to touch with them. Talk about building relationships with your guys. Obviously, this was your first year. You're inheriting a whole roster of players that you didn't recruit, that you had really no previous relationship with. So how do you build the kinds of relationships that I know are important to you, so that you can coach those guys hard and so you can have the type of, again, relationships that are going to be long-term and not just about, hey, how are we winning and losing on the court?
They're gone home right now. They go for the summer, and so there's not a lot of time during the offseason. Of course, me being a new coach, didn't have time anyway for them to really get to know me. So tried everything that I could, spent every second of the day texting, calling. Again, they're really busy at Berea College, so there's never just a great time for, hey, you want to go to lunch and hang out for an hour or two? It's just they're so busy. So it took a lot of planning and, of course, having a brand-new team of guys that didn't know me, brand-new coach coming in. It was really me just trying to figure out ways to get to those guys, to let them know that I care about them, that I wanted basketball to be fun. Wanted them to come to practice and get away kind of from the stress of Berea College, of how hard it is from your job. So just try to do things in practice, before practice, after practice, for them to have fun and enjoy themselves. Huge on family. I've got two kids of my own that always come to practice and show up and spend time with our players, have them over to the house, have team dinners, but just as much as we can do to promote, hey, we're all in this together. I know we don't know each other very well, but like, I'm here for you, want you to have a great experience. Just tried to do a lot of that here in year one.
As you build those relationships and you're in a practice setting, you're on the road with guys, you're really trying to develop that team chemistry, and you're trying to build bonds between players. One of the things that becomes important is developing leaders on your team. It's always said, right, that a player-led team is better than a coach-led team. So when you think about the concept of leadership and trying to develop leaders on your team, what does that look like? How do you go about trying to develop the leadership of whether it's all your players or just trying to pull out a leader or two that kind of steps to the forefront for you?
Mentioned his name a little while ago, a guy named Isaac Cottle, who unfortunately graduated, but he is probably my most favorite player I've ever coached. I've told him that. I hope it's no offense to any other guys that I've coached, but this guy literally, he's married. He's got a wife. He's a fifth year guy. So he's married. He was teaching middle school math. He's an education major. He's about 6'4", and I'm not going to call him any names, but he wasn't in the best shape physically. Like, his body didn't look great, but just the ultimate teammate, leader, shot 40% from three, 90% from the free throw line, would take two or three charges a game. Just unbelievable how hard he played. Led our conference in rebounding at 6'4". I mean, just unbelievable heart, will, and soul. And he was just the ultimate leader. And so we're losing him, but he was a huge help to me as I got the job, just kind of talking to me about different guys, personalities of, hey, we did this last year, but I think we should do this. Just he's going to be really hard to replace. But hopefully the guys that were on our team last year, you know, really learned from his example. He just got a job as an assistant high school basketball coach. So that high school is getting ready to be impacted in a great way by Isaac Cottle. But he, in my book, is one of the greatest leaders I've ever been around. And we need more guys to be like him.
How do you think you can get people to step into that role? What are some things that when you start looking at next year's team, you think about the personnel you have coming back, what are some opportunities that maybe you can create or will create for your players to step into that leadership void that Isaac leaving has sort of left?
Yeah, I think at this level, they get the opportunity a lot because we're just not allowed to be in the gym with them. So, of course, I'm not able to, like, go to a workout and say, hey, you know, Bryce Riley, who's a freshman, he's really stepping up as a leader. I'm not able to see that. And so what Isaac was great about doing was just, you know, communicating like, hey, coach, I know you can't be there, but we're playing open gym tonight at 7:00. Just want to let you know, and yada, yada, yada. And so just a guy that wants to take ownership of the team and basically be the coach when the head coach can't be there. And so I think once you hit that October 15th date, that it'll really come out of who the leaders are and who the leaders have been over the summer and in the off season. Because those guys will step up when it's time to step up when that practice starts.
How'd you handle the end of the season in terms of meeting with your guys and kind of talking about what the first season with you looked like and then what your expectations were for them heading into next season, and talking about, again, how the summer was going to go and what guys needed to be doing? Did you have team meeting, individual meetings? Just how'd you handle the end of the season this year?
Did have a couple team meetings, just kind of gave them the schedule for, you know, our summer camps and when we expected them to be back and all that stuff, but also met individually with each guy and basically had a 30-minute meeting with each player on our team and talked about season in review, talked about kind of some things they can work on during the summer, and then expectations for next season, from, you know, looking at the stat sheet to looking at, hey, your three-point percentage was this. I think it needs to be this. From threes to grades to life to how's your mom, just trying to, you know, recap the season and send them off feeling good about coming back to Berea College basketball, but also giving them some things during the summer specifically of you can improve in this area and it's really going to help our team. So it's one thing to just give workouts and say, hey, this is what you need to do. It's another thing to say, hey, you shot 28% from three last year. If you can get that number up to 35%, it really helps our team win. So just being specific with each guy, I think hopefully will help them during the summer.
Now, did you get down to the point where you're giving them individual drills and things that, hey, here's something specific, this is what it should look like? Or are you talking more in terms of, hey, we need you to improve as a three-point shooter, go and figure out what you need to do in order to get that percentage where you need it? How specific are you diving down into what you want them doing on the floor in those meetings?
Yeah, so we really value shooting, and we only shot 31% from three this year, and we still won 15. We were 15-11. And so, like, my whole system offensively is built around making threes. And I'm just thinking to myself, if we can go 15-11 and be 31% from three, like, just imagine, like, when we start making shots, how good we could be.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, we do a lot of shooting during practice, have a lot of different drills that are timed that we have goals for. And so instead of giving them just made up shooting drills, I'll basically say, hey, you know, the Hubies that we do, or the top of the key threes in 1 minute that we do, like, that would be really good for you to do every single day during the summer. Just give them things that they already know that we do in practice, so it's not some brand new drill, but can get very specific with each guy of, hey, this drill would be better for you than, you know, doing Hubies for 30 seconds.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I think if they're familiar with what you already do in practice, you could say, hey, just double down on this particular drill or these particular things that you already know how to do. That makes a lot more sense than showing them something that completely is brand new to them. Again, I think they're going to benefit from that. And then obviously they come back and you're designing your drills around what you do in game. So it makes a lot of sense to be able to give them something to go on that they're already familiar with. When you look ahead to next season and you think about where you are right now on June 1st, and where you want to go, not just next year, but in the future, what do you see as being the biggest challenge or two that you're going to need to overcome in order to get where you want to go to be able to live up to the vision that you have for the program there at Berea?
Biggest challenge would be post players. So when you think about, I know at every level, I mean, even at Division I, it's hard to find good post players. And so last year, like I said, we only had one guy over 6'4", just really struggled at times against, you know, bigger, stronger, more physical teams to rebound, and it hurt us a lot of times. Now, we do really put a value on taking care of the basketball. We were top 20 in the country in valuing the ball. We like to pressure defensively and create turnovers. So we try to make up with our lack of rebounding by, you know, taking care of the ball and forcing turnovers. But at some point, I think the biggest challenge is to find that post presence that can just dominate the paint. And so we do have a couple guys, 6'5", 6'6", coming in that we think that could be really good in time. I love our guards. We got all of our guards back pretty much, other than Isaac Cottle, who I've talked about. So really like our guards for next season. It's just, can we find us a post presence that can really battle with those bigs in our league? And I just, you know, from a facility standpoint, from a recruiting standpoint, budget standpoint, like, I think I've got everything that I need as the head coach of Berea College to make this place really successful. And so I'm excited about that. So I don't see a lot of challenges. Like, I do feel like we've got everything we need to be successful at this level.
And you mentioned to us before we jumped on that you got some news today that you guys are joining a new conference. So talk a little bit about that and how that impacts, I guess, the way you approach, probably doesn't impact the way you approach your team, but just how that's going to impact the scheduling and just the things that are going to have an effect on the program.
And so found out today that we're going to be joining the Heartland Conference, not this coming season, but the following season in 2024, which is exciting. It's a great basketball league. Geographically makes much more sense than the league we're in now, which we do really enjoy the league that we're in now. And I've formed great relationships with the head coaches around the league. So it's going to be hard to be in that league for 2 years and leave, but also think long-term, it makes more sense for us to be a member of the Heartland. Transylvania, which is in Lexington, used to be a big rival of Berea back when they were both NAIA schools. So that's a game and a rivalry. We're really looking forward to reuniting, getting that game back. But I think the best part about it is just the travel is going to be so much better than the league we're in now. So league we're in now, the Collegiate Conference of the South, we play Belhaven, which is a 12-hour bus trip. Luckily, we got to fly last year, but Most of the schools we play is at least a 6-7 hour drive. And so just makes it really tough, especially with how hard Berea is academically to miss class and to get back at 2 and 3 in the morning. And I think being in this new league is just going to be great from a basketball standpoint, but also academically and geographically.
Yeah. I think just the opportunity, as you said, and we talked about before the podcast, to cut down on travel, and it makes a lot more sense, much easier on your student athletes. And as we talked about before, the uniqueness of your institution and the academics and the work and all the things that go into it to be a great basketball program. I think it should be a good change for you guys there at Berea. All right. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you one final question. When you think about what you get to do every single day and being the head coach at Berea College and just going into your job and sitting in the office, what brings you the most joy about what you get to do each and every day?
I tell our athletic director all the time, like, I feel like I've got the best basketball job in America. I mean, I'm probably not making the money that high major coaches are making, but like, you give a beautiful facility at a Division III school that my players are very grateful and appreciative of everything that I do for them. You can go to school here for no tuition. Division III basketball is a full student athlete experience. Right now, like I said, I've got 2 kids, and this is no offense to anybody that's out there grinding as a coach, but I just turned 40 years old, and I've lived the grind of, you know, being a Division I player. I've lived the grind of being a Division I assistant. I've lived the grind of being a high school head coach. And so as bad as I hate not being able to be with my team during the summer, it's also a great chance for me to refresh and be with my family and be a dad, coach my kids. My son's playing a lot of golf, so I get to caddy for him. So just being able to do those things, but also be a college head basketball coach, like it almost seems too good to be true when I wake up in the morning. So I don't know if I said that very well, but just very happy with my job and the college that I'm at and the mission of the school and the guys I get to coach.
That's well said. I mean, I think when you start talking about being able to have that balance and being able to spend time with your family, to be able to coach at an institution that you love and be able to coach guys that you care about, and you see on the horizon that the ability to win where you are, to me, all those things are critically important. And the fact that all that resonates with you, I think is well said. So let's, before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, whether you want to share email, social media, website, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
So my email address is newtonj2@berea.edu. So you can obviously email me anytime you want. I am on all social media platforms, probably too much. spend a lot of time on there, but my Twitter is @AustinNewton, all one word, @AustinNewton. We do have a Berea College Twitter account as well for our men's basketball team, which we try to put some good content out there and really promote our guys and our college. Also on Instagram and Facebook. So find me on any of those and would love to talk with anybody about the great opportunity here at Berea College.
Austin, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to jump on and join us. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.